Giving Miss Sasaki a local anesthetic of procaine, Dr. Sasaki made an incision in her leg on October 23rd to drain the infection, which still lingered on 11 weeks after the injury. In the following days, so much pus formed that he had to dress the opening each morning and evening. A week later, she complained of great pain, so he made another incision. He cut still a third on November 9th and enlarged it on the 26th. All this time, Miss Sasaki grew weaker and weaker, and her spirits fell low. One day, the young man who had lent her his translation of De Maupassant at Hatsukaichi came to visit her. He told her that he was going to Kyushu, but that when he came back, he would like to see her again. She didn't care. Her leg had been so swollen and painful all along that the doctor had not even tried to set the fractures, and though an X-ray taken in November showed that the bones were mending, she could see under the sheet that her left leg was nearly 3 inches shorter than her right, and that her left foot was turning inward. She thought often of the man to whom she had been engaged. Someone told her he was back from overseas. She wondered what he had heard about her injuries that made him stay away. Father Kleinsorger was discharged from the hospital in Tokyo on December 19th and took a train home. On the way, 2 days later at Yokogawa, a stop just before Hiroshima, Dr. Fuji boarded the train. It was the first time the two men had met since before the bombing. They sat together. Dr. Fuji said he was going to the annual gathering of his family on the anniversary of his father's death. When they started talking about their experiences, the doctor was quite entertaining as he told how his places of residence kept falling into rivers. Then he asked Father Kleinsorger how he was, and the Jesuit talked about his stay in the hospital. "The doctors told me to be cautious," he said. "They ordered me to have a 2-hour nap every afternoon." Dr. Fuji said, "It's hard to be cautious in Hiroshima these days. Everyone seems to be so busy." A new municipal government, set up under Allied military government direction, had gone to work at last in the city hall. Citizens who had recovered from various degrees of radiation sickness were coming back by the thousand. By November 1st, the population, mostly crowded into the outskirts, was already 137,000, more than a third of the wartime peak, and the government set in motion all kinds of projects to put them to work rebuilding the city. It hired men to clear the streets, and others to gather scrap iron, which they sorted and piled in mountains opposite the city hall. Some returning residents were putting up their own shanties and huts and planting small squares of winter wheat beside them, but the city also authorized and built 400 one-family barracks. Utilities were repaired. Electric lights shone again, trams started running, and employees of the waterworks fixed 70,000 leaks in mains and plumbing. A planning conference with an enthusiastic young military government officer, Lieutenant John D. Montgomery of Kalamazoo, as its advisor, began to consider what sort of city the new Hiroshima should be. The ruined city had flourished and had been an inviting target, mainly because it had been one of the most important military command and communications centers in Japan, and would have become the imperial headquarters had the islands been invaded and Tokyo been captured. Now there would be no huge military establishments to help revive the city. The planning conference, at a loss as to just what importance Hiroshima could have, fell back on rather vague cultural and paving projects. It drew maps with avenues 100 yards wide and thought seriously of erecting a group of buildings as a monument to the disaster and naming them the Institute of International Amity. Statistical workers gathered what figures they could on the effects of the bomb. They reported that 78,150 people had been killed, 13,983 were missing, and 37,425 had been injured. No one in the city government pretended that these figures were accurate, though the Americans accepted them as official, and as the months went by and more hundreds of corpses were dug up from the ruins, and as the number of unclaimed urns of ashes at the Zempoji Temple in Koi rose into the thousands, the statisticians began to say that at least 100,000 people had lost their lives in the bombing. Since many people died of a combination of causes, it was impossible to figure exactly how many were killed by each cause, but the statisticians calculated that about 25% had died of direct burns from the bomb, about 50% from other injuries, and about 20% as a result of radiation effects. The statisticians' figures on property damage were more reliable. 62,000 out of 90,000 buildings destroyed, and 6,000 more damaged beyond repair. In the heart of the city, they found only 5 modern buildings that could be used again without major repairs. This small number was by no means the fault of flimsy Japanese construction. In fact, since the 1923 earthquake, Japanese building regulations had required that the roof of each large building be able to bear a minimum load of 70 pounds per square foot, whereas American regulations don't normally specify more than 40 pounds per square foot. Scientists swarmed into the city. Some of them measured the force that had been necessary to shift marble gravestones in the cemeteries, to knock over 22 of the 47 railroad cars in the yards at Hiroshima Station, to lift and move the concrete roadway on one of the bridges, and to perform other noteworthy acts of strength, and concluded that the pressure exerted by the explosion varied from 5.3 to 8.0 tons per square yard. Others found that mica, of which the melting point is 900 degrees centigrade, had fused on granite gravestones 380 yards from the center. The telephone poles of Cryptomeria japonica, whose carbonization temperature is 240 degrees centigrade, had been charred at 4,400 yards from the center, and that the surface of gray clay tiles of the type used in Hiroshima, whose melting point is 1,300 degrees centigrade, had dissolved at 600 yards. And after examining other significant ashes and melted bits, they concluded that the bomb's heat on the ground at the center must have been 6,000 degrees centigrade. And from further measurements of radiation, which involved, among other things, the scraping up of fission fragments from roof troughs and drain pipes as far away as the suburb of Takasu, 3,300 yards from the center, they learned some far more important facts about the nature of the bomb. General MacArthur's headquarters systematically censored all mention of the bomb in Japanese scientific publications. But soon the fruit of the scientists' calculations became common knowledge among Japanese physicists, doctors, chemists, journalists, professors, and, no doubt, those statesmen and military men who were still in circulation. Long before the American public had been told, most of the scientists and lots of non-scientists in Japan knew, from the calculations of Japanese nuclear physicists, that a uranium bomb had exploded at Hiroshima and a more powerful one of plutonium at Nagasaki. They also knew that theoretically one 10 times as powerful, or 20, could be developed. The Japanese scientists thought they knew the exact height at which the bomb at Hiroshima was exploded and the approximate weight of the uranium used. They estimated that even with the primitive bomb used at Hiroshima, it would require a shelter of concrete 50 inches thick to protect a human being entirely from radiation sickness. The scientists had these and other details, which remained subject to security in the United States, printed and mimeographed and bound into little books. The Americans knew of the existence of these, but tracing them and seeing that they did not fall into the wrong hands would have obliged the occupying authorities to set up, for this one purpose alone, an enormous police system in Japan. Altogether, the Japanese scientists were somewhat amused at the efforts of their conquerors to keep security on atomic fission. Late in February 1946, a friend of Miss Sasaki's called on Father Kleinsorge and asked him to visit her in the hospital. She had been growing more and more depressed and morbid. She seemed little interested in living. Father Kleinsorge went to see her several times. On his first visit, he kept the conversation general, formal, and yet vaguely sympathetic and didn't mention religion. Miss Sasaki herself brought it up the second time he dropped in on her. Evidently, she had had some talks with a Catholic. She asked bluntly, "If your God is so good and kind, how can he let people suffer like this?" She made a gesture which took in her shrunken leg, the other patients in her room, and Hiroshima as a whole. "My child," Father Kleinsorger said, "man is not now in the condition God intended. He has fallen from grace through sin." And he went on to explain all the reasons for everything. It came to Mrs. Nakamura's attention that a carpenter from Kabe was building a number of wooden shanties in Hiroshima, which he rented for 50 yen a month, about 50 cents at the fixed rate of exchange. Mrs. Nakamura had lost the certificates for her bonds and other wartime savings, but fortunately she had copied off all the numbers just a few days before the bombing and had taken the list to Kabe, and so, when her hair had grown in enough for her to be presentable, she went to her bank in Hiroshima, and the clerk there told her that after checking her numbers against the records, the bank would give her her money. As soon as she got it, she rented one of the carpenter's shacks. It was in Noboricho, near the site of her former house, and though its floor was dirt and it was dark inside, it was at least a home in Hiroshima, and she was no longer dependent on the charity of her in-laws. During the spring, she cleared away some nearby wreckage and planted a vegetable garden. She cooked with utensils and ate off plates she scavenged from the debris. She sent Mieko to the kindergarten, which the Jesuits reopened, and the two older children attended Noboricho Primary School, which, for want of buildings, held classes out of doors. Toshio wanted to study to be a mechanic, like his hero, Hideo Osaki. Prices were high. By midsummer, Mrs. Nakamura's savings were gone. She sold some of her clothes to get food. She had once had several expensive kimonos, but during the war one had been stolen. She had given one to a sister who had been bombed out in Tokuyama. She had lost a couple in the Hiroshima bombing, and now she sold her last one. It brought only 100 yen, which didn't last long. In June, she went to Father Kleinsorger for advice about how to get along, and in early August, she was still considering the two alternatives he suggested: taking work as a domestic for some of the Allied occupation forces, or borrowing from her relatives enough money, about 500 yen, or a bit more than $30, to repair her rusty sewing machine and resume the work of a seamstress. When Mr. Tanimoto returned from Shikoku, he draped a tent he owned over the roof of the badly damaged house he had rented in Ushida. The roof still leaked, but he conducted services in the damp living room. He began thinking about raising money to restore his church in the city. He became quite friendly with Father Kleinsorger and saw the Jesuits often. He envied them their church's wealth. They seemed to be able to do anything they wanted. He had nothing to work with except his own energy, and that was not what it had been. The Society of Jesus had been the first institution to build a relatively permanent shanty in the ruins of Hiroshima. That had been while Father Kleinsorger was in the hospital. As soon as he got back, he began living in the shack, and he and another priest, Father Larimann, who had joined him in the mission, arranged for the purchase of 3 of the standardized barracks, which the city was selling at 7,000 yen apiece. They put 2 together, end to end, and made a pretty chapel of them. They ate in the third. When materials were available, they commissioned a contractor to build a 3-story mission house exactly like the one that had been destroyed in the fire. In the compound, carpenters cut timbers, gouged mortises, shaped tenons, whittled scores of wooden pegs and bored holes for them until all the parts for the house were in a neat pile. Then, in 3 days, they put the whole thing together, like an Oriental puzzle, without any nails at all. Father Kleinsorger was finding it hard, as Dr. Fuji had suggested he would, to be cautious and to take his naps. He went out every day on foot to call on Japanese Catholics and prospective converts. As the months went by, he grew more and more tired. In June, he read an article in the Hiroshima Chugoku warning survivors against working too hard. But what could he do? By July, he was worn out, and early in August, almost exactly on the anniversary of the bombing, he went back to the Catholic International Hospital in Tokyo for a month's rest. Whether or not Father Kleinsorge's answers to Miss Sasaki's questions about life were final and absolute truths, she seemed quickly to draw physical strength from them. Dr. Sasaki noticed it and congratulated Father Kleinsorge. By April 15th, her temperature and white count were normal, and the infection in the wound was beginning to clear up. On the 20th, there was almost no pus, and for the first time she jerked along a corridor on crutches. 5 days later, the wound had begun to heal, and on the last day of the month, she was discharged. During the early summer, she prepared herself for conversion to Catholicism. In that period, she had ups and downs. Her depressions were deep. She knew she would always be a cripple. Her fiancé never came to see her. There was nothing for her to do except read and look out from her house on a hillside in Koi across the ruins of the city where her parents and brother died. She was nervous, and any sudden noise made her put her hands quickly to her throat. Her leg still hurt. She rubbed it often and patted it, as if to console it. It took 6 months for the Red Cross Hospital and even longer for Dr. Sasaki to get back to normal. Until the city restored electric power, the hospital had to limp along with the aid of a Japanese Army generator in its backyard. Operating tables, X-ray machines, dentist chairs, everything complicated and essential came in a trickle of charity from other cities. In Japan, face is important even to institutions. And long before the Red Cross Hospital was back to par on basic medical equipment, its directors put up a new yellow brick veneer facade, so the hospital became the handsomest building in Hiroshima, from the street. For the first 4 months, Dr. Sasaki was the only surgeon on the staff, and he almost never left the building. Then, gradually, he began to take an interest in his own life again. He got married in March. He gained back some of the weight he lost, but his appetite remained only fair. Before the bombing, he used to eat 4 rice balls at every meal, but a year after it, he could manage only 2. He felt tired all the time. "But I have to realize," he said, "that the whole community is tired." A year after the bomb was dropped, Miss Sasaki was a cripple. Mrs. Nakamura was destitute. Father Kleinsorge was back in the hospital. Dr. Sasaki was not capable of the work he once could do. Dr. Fuji had lost the 30-room hospital it took him many years to acquire and had no prospects of rebuilding it. Mr. Tanimoto's church had been ruined, and he no longer had his exceptional vitality. The lives of these 6 people, who were among the luckiest in Hiroshima, would never be the same. What they thought of their experiences and of the use of the atomic bomb was, of course, not unanimous. One feeling they did seem to share, however, was a curious kind of elated community spirit, something like that of the Londoners after their Blitz, a pride in the way they and their fellow survivors had stood up to a dreadful ordeal. Just before the anniversary, Mr. Tanimoto wrote in a letter to an American some words which expressed this feeling. "What a heartbreaking scene this was the first night. About midnight I landed on the riverbank. So many injured people lied on the ground that I made my way by striding over them. Repeating, 'Excuse me,' I forwarded and carried a tub of water with me and gave a cup of water to each one of them. They raised their upper bodies slowly and accepted a cup of water with a bow and drunk quietly and, spilling any remnant, gave back a cup with hearty expression of their thankfulness and said, 'I couldn't help my sister who was buried under the house because I had to take care of my mother who got a deep wound on her eye and our house soon set fire and we hardly escaped. Look, I lost my home, my family, and at last myself bitterly injured. But now I have guided my mind to dedicate what I have and to complete the war for our country's sake.' Thus they pledged to me, even women and children did the same. Being entirely tired, I lied down on the ground among them, but couldn't sleep at all. Next morning I found many men and women dead, whom I gave water last night. But to my great surprise, I never heard any one cried in disorder, even though they suffered in great agony. They died in silence, with no grudge, setting their teeth to bear it, all for the country. Dr. Y. Hirayua, professor of Hiroshima University of Literature and Science, and one of my church members, was buried by the bomb under the two-storied house with his son, a student of Tokyo University. Both of them could not move an inch under tremendously heavy pressure, and the house already caught fire. His son said, "Father, we can do nothing except make our mind up to consecrate our lives for the country. Let us give banzai to our emperor." Then the father followed after his son, "Tenoheika, banzai, banzai, banzai." In the result, Dr. Hirayua said, "Strange to say, I felt calm and bright and peaceful spirit in my heart when I chanted banzai to Tenno." Afterward, his son got out and digged down and pulled out his father, and thus they were saved. In thinking of their experience of that time, Dr. Hirayua repeated, "What a fortunate that we are Japanese. It was my first time I ever tasted such a beautiful spirit when I decided to die for our emperor." Miss Kayoko Nabutoki, a student of Girls High School, Hiroshima Jokakuin, and a daughter of my church member, was taking rest with her friends beside the heavy fence of the Buddhist temple. At the moment the atomic bomb was dropped, the fence fell upon them. They could not move a bit under such a heavy fence, and then smoke entered into even a crack and choked their breath. One of the girls began to sing Kimi ga yo, national anthem, and others followed in chorus and died. Meanwhile, one of them found a crack and struggled hard to get out. When she was taken in the Red Cross hospital, she told how her friends died, tracing back in her memory to singing in chorus our national anthem. They were just 13 years old. Yes, people of Hiroshima died manly in the atomic bombing, believing that it was for emperor's sake. A surprising number of the people of Hiroshima remained more or less indifferent about the ethics of using the bomb. Possibly they were too terrified by it to want to think about it at all. Not many of them even bothered to find out much about what it was like. Mrs. Nakamura's conception of it, and awe of it, was typical. "The atom bomb," she would say when asked about it, "is the size of a matchbox. The heat of it is 6,000 times that of the sun. It exploded in the air. There is some radium in it. I don't know just how it works, but when the radium is put together, it explodes." As for the use of the bomb, she would say, "It was war, and we had to expect it." And then she would add, "Shikata ga nai," a Japanese expression as common as and corresponding to the Russian word nichevo. "It can't be helped. Oh well, too bad." Dr. Fuji said approximately the same thing about the use of the bomb to Father Kleinsorger one evening in German. "Da ist nichts zu machen." There's nothing to be done about it. Many citizens of Hiroshima, however, continued to feel a hatred for Americans which nothing could possibly erase. "I see," Dr. Sasaki once said, "that they are holding a trial for war criminals in Tokyo just now. I think they ought to try the men who decided to use the bomb, and they should hang them all." Father Kleinsorger and the other German Jesuit priests, who, as foreigners, could be expected to take a relatively detached view, often discussed the ethics of using the bomb. One of them, Father Zimes, who was out at Nagatsuka at the time of the attack, wrote in a report to the Holy See in Rome, "Some of us consider the bomb in the same category as poison gas, and were against its use on a civilian population. Others were of the opinion that in total war, as carried on in Japan, there was no difference between civilians and soldiers. and that the bomb itself was an effective force tending to end the bloodshed, warning Japan to surrender and thus to avoid total destruction. It seems logical that he who supports total war in principle cannot complain of a war against civilians. The crux of the matter is whether total war in its present form is justifiable, even when it serves a just purpose. Does it not have material and spiritual evil as its consequences, which far exceed whatever good might result? When will our moralists give us a clear answer to this question? It would be impossible to say what horrors were embedded in the minds of the children who lived through the day of the bombing in Hiroshima. On the surface, their recollections, months after the disaster, were of an exhilarating adventure. Toshio Nakamura, who was 10 at the time of the bombing, was soon able to talk freely, even gaily, about the experience, and a few weeks before the anniversary, he wrote the following matter-of-fact essay for his teacher at Noboricho Primary School. "The day before the bomb, I went for a swim. In the morning, I was eating peanuts. I saw a light. I was knocked to little sister's sleeping place. When we were saved, I could only see as far as the tram. My mother and I started to pack our things. The neighbors were walking around burned and bleeding. Hataya-san told me to run away with her. I said I wanted to wait for my mother. We went to the park. A whirlwind came. At night, a gas tank burned, and I saw the reflection in the river. We stayed in the park one night. Next day, I went to Taiko Bridge and met my girlfriends, Kikuki and Murakami. They were looking for their mothers. But Kikuki's mother was wounded, and Murakami's mother, alas, was dead." Chapter 5. The Aftermath. 1. Hatsuyo Nakamura. Hatsuyo Nakamura, weak and destitute, began a courageous struggle which would last for many years to keep her children and herself alive. She had her rusted Sankoku machine repaired and began to take in some sewing, and she did cleaning and laundry and washed dishes for neighbors who were somewhat better off than she was. But she got so tired that she had to take 2 days' rest for every 3 days she worked. And if she was obliged for some reason to work for a whole week, she had then to rest for 3 or 4 days. She earned barely enough for food. At this precarious time, she fell ill. Her belly began to swell up, and she had diarrhea and so much pain she could no longer work at all. A doctor who lived nearby came to see her and told her she had roundworm. And he said, incorrectly, "If it bites your intestine, you'll die." In those days, there was a shortage of chemical fertilizers in Japan, so farmers were using night soil, and as a consequence, many people began to harbor parasites, which were not fatal in themselves, but were seriously debilitating to those who had had radiation sickness. The doctor treated Nakamura-san, as he would have addressed her, with santonin, a somewhat dangerous medicine derived from certain varieties of artemisia. To pay the doctor, she was forced to sell her last valuable possession, her husband's sewing machine. She came to think of that act as marking the lowest and saddest moment of her whole life. In referring to those who went through the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings, the Japanese tended to shy away from the term survivors, because in its focus on being alive, it might suggest some slight to the sacred dead. The class of people to which Nakamura-san belonged came, therefore, to be called by a more neutral name, Hibakusha, literally explosion-affected persons. For more than a decade after the bombings, the Hibakusha lived in an economic limbo, apparently because the Japanese government did not want to find itself saddled with anything like moral responsibility for heinous acts of the victorious United States. Although it soon became clear that many Hibakusha suffered consequences of their exposure to the bombs, which were quite different in nature and degree from those of survivors even of the ghastly firebombings in Tokyo and elsewhere, the government made no special provision for their relief, until, ironically, after the storm of rage that swept across Japan when the 23 crewmen of a fishing vessel, the Lucky Dragon No. 5, and its cargo of tuna were irradiated by the American test of a hydrogen bomb at Bikini in 1954. It took 3 years even then for a relief law for the Hibakusha to pass the Diet. Though Nakamura-san could not know it, she thus had a bleak period ahead of her. In Hiroshima, the early post-war years were, besides, a time especially painful for poor people like her of disorder, hunger, greed, thievery, black markets. Non-Hibakusha employers developed a prejudice against the survivors as word got around that they were prone to all sorts of ailments, and that even those like Nakamura-san, who were not cruelly maimed and had not developed any serious overt symptoms, were unreliable workers, since most of them seemed to suffer, as she did, from the mysterious but real malaise that came to be known as one kind of lasting A-bomb sickness, a nagging weakness and weariness, dizziness now and then, digestive troubles, all aggravated by a feeling of oppression, a sense of doom. For it was said that unspeakable diseases might at any time plant nasty flowers in the bodies of their victims, and even in those of their descendants. As Nakamura-san struggled to get from day to day, she had no time for attitudinizing about the bomb or anything else. She was sustained, curiously, by a kind of passivity, summed up in a phrase she herself sometimes used, shikataganai, meaning loosely, it can't be helped. She was not religious, but she lived in a culture long colored by the Buddhist belief that resignation might lead to clear vision. She had shared with other citizens a deep feeling of powerlessness in the face of a state authority that had been divinely strong ever since the Meiji Restoration in 1868. And the hell she had witnessed and the terrible aftermath unfolding around her reached so far beyond human understanding that it was impossible to think of them as the work of resentable human beings, such as the pilot of the Enola Gay, or President Truman, or the scientists who had made the bomb, or even, nearer at hand, the Japanese militarists who had helped to bring on the war. The bombing almost seemed a natural disaster, one that it had simply been her bad luck, her fate, which must be accepted, to suffer. When she had been wormed and felt slightly better, she made an arrangement to deliver bread for a baker named Takahashi, whose bakery was in Noboricho. On days when she had the strength to do it, she would take orders for bread from retail shops in her neighborhood, and the next morning she would pick up the requisite number of loaves and carry them in baskets and boxes through the streets to the stores. It was exhausting work, for which she earned the equivalent of about 50 cents a day. She had to take frequent rest days. After some time, when she was feeling a bit stronger, she took up another kind of peddling. She would get up in the dark and trundle a borrowed two-wheeled pushcart for 2 hours across the city to a section called Eba at the mouth of one of the 7 estuarial rivers that branch from the Ota River through Hiroshima. There, at daylight, fishermen would cast their leaded skirt-like nets for sardines, and she would help them to gather up the catch when they hauled it in. Then she would push the cart back to Noboricho and sell the fish for them from door to door. She earned just enough for food. A couple of years later, she found work that was better suited to her need for occasional rest, because within certain limits, she could do it on her own time. This was a job of collecting money for deliveries of the Hiroshima paper, the Chugoku Shimbun, which most people in the city read. She had to cover a big territory, and often her clients were not at home, or pleaded that they couldn't pay just then, so she would have to go back again and again. She earned the equivalent of about $20 a month at this job. Every day, her willpower and her weariness seemed to fight to an uneasy draw.
This ends Disc 3, Hiroshima. Disc 4.
In 1951, after years of this drudgery, it was Nakamura-san's good luck, her fate, which must be accepted, to become eligible to move into a better house. 2 years earlier, a Quaker professor of dendrology from the University of Washington named Floyd W. Schmo, driven apparently by deep urges for expiation and reconciliation, had come to Hiroshima, assembled a team of carpenters, and with his own hands and theirs, begun building a series of Japanese-style houses for victims of the bomb. In all, his team eventually built 21. It was to one of these houses that Nakamura-san had the good fortune to be assigned. The Japanese measure their houses by multiples of the area of the floor-covering tsubo mat, a little less than 4 square yards. And the Dr. Shumo houses, as the Hiroshimans called them, had 2 rooms of 6 mats each. This was a big step up for the Nakamuras. This home was redolent of new wood and clean matting. The rent, payable to the city government, was the equivalent of about $1 a month. Despite the family's poverty, the children seemed to be growing normally. Yaeko and Mieko, the 2 daughters, were anemic, but all 3 had so far escaped any of the more serious complications that so many young hibakusha were suffering. Yaeko, now 14, and Mieko, 11, were in middle school. The boy, Toshio, ready to enter high school, was going to have to earn money to attend it, so he took up delivering papers to the places from which his mother was collecting. These were some distance from their Dr. Shumo house, and they had to commute at odd hours by streetcar. The old hut in Noboricho stood empty for a time, and while continuing with her newspaper collections, Nakamura-san converted it into a small street shop for children, selling sweet potatoes, which she roasted, and dagashi, or little candies and rice cakes, and cheap toys, which she bought from a wholesaler. All along she had been collecting for papers from a small company, Suyama Chemical, that made mothballs sold under the trade name Paragen. A friend of hers worked there, and one day the friend suggested to Nakamura-san that she join the company, helping wrap the product in its packages. The owner, Nakamura-san learned, was a compassionate man who did not share the bias of many employers against hibakusha. He had several on his staff of 20 women wrappers. Nakamura-san objected that she couldn't work more than a few days at a time. The friend persuaded her that Mr. Suyama would understand that. So she began. Dressed in company uniforms, the women stood somewhat bent over on either side of a couple of conveyor belts, working as fast as possible to wrap 2 kinds of Paragen in cellophane. Paragen had a dizzying odor, and at first it made one's eyes smart. Its substance, powdered paradichlorobenzene, had been compressed into lozenge-shaped mothballs and into larger spheres the size of small oranges to be hung in Japanese-style toilets, where their rank pseudo-medicinal smell would offset the unpleasantness of non-flushing facilities. Nakamura-san was paid, as a beginner, 170 yen, then less than 50 cents, a day. At first, the work was confusing, terribly tiring, and a bit sickening. Her boss worried about her paleness. She had to take many days off, but little by little she became used to the factory. She made friends. There was a family atmosphere. She got raises. In the 2 10-minute breaks, morning and afternoon, when the moving belt stopped, there was a birdsong of gossip and laughter in which she joined. It appeared that all along there had been, deep in her temperament, a core of cheerfulness, which must have fueled her long fight against A-bomb lassitude, something warmer and more vivifying than mere submission, than saying shikata ganai. The other women took to her. She was constantly doing them small favors. They began calling her affectionately Oba-san, roughly auntie. She worked at Suyama for 13 years. Though her energy still paid its dues, from time to time, to the A-bomb syndrome, the searing experiences of that day in 1945 seemed gradually to be receding from the front of her mind. The Lucky Dragon No. 5 episode took place in 1954, the year after Nakamura-san started working for Suyama Chemical. In the ensuing fever of outrage in the country, the provision of adequate medical care for the victims of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs finally became a political issue. Almost every year since 1946, on the anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing, a peace memorial meeting had been held in a park that the city planners had set aside during the city's rebuilding as a center of remembrance, and on August 6, 1955, delegates from all over the world gathered there for the first World Conference Against Atomic and Hydrogen Bombs. On its second day, a number of Hibakusha tearfully testified to the government's neglect of their plight. Japanese political parties took up the cause, and in 1957, the Diet at last passed the A-bomb victims' medical care law. This law and its subsequent modifications defined four classes of people who would be eligible for support: those who had been in the city limits on the day of the bombing, those who had entered an area within 2 kilometers of the hypocenter in the first 14 days after it, those who had come into physical contact with bomb victims in administering first aid or in disposing of their bodies, and those who had been embryos in the wombs of women in any of the first 3 categories. These hibakusha were entitled to receive so-called health books, which would entitle them to free medical treatment. Later revisions of the law provided for monthly allowances to victims suffering from various aftereffects. Like a great many hibakusha, Nakamura-san had kept away from all the agitation, and, in fact, also like many other survivors, she did not even bother to get a health book for a couple of years after they were issued. She had been too poor to keep going to doctors, so she had got into the habit of coping alone, as best she could, with whatever ailed her. Besides, she shared with some other survivors a suspicion of ulterior motives on the part of the political-minded people who took part in the annual ceremonies and conferences. Nakamura-san's son, Toshio, right after his graduation from high school, went to work for the bus division of the Japanese National Railways. He was in the administrative offices, working first on timetables, later in accounting. When he was in his mid-20s, a marriage was arranged for him through a relative who knew the bride's family. He built an addition to the Dr. Shumo house, moved in, and began to contribute to his mother's support. He made her a present of a new sewing machine. Yaeko, the older daughter, left Hiroshima when she was 15, right after graduating from middle school, to help an ailing aunt who ran a ryokan, a Japanese-style inn. There, in due course, she fell in love with a man who ate at the inn's restaurant, and she made a love marriage. After graduating from high school, Mieko, the most susceptible of the 3 children to the A-bomb syndrome, eventually became an expert typist and took up instructing at typing schools. In time, a marriage was arranged for her. Like their mother, all 3 children avoided pro-hibakusha and anti-nuclear agitation. In 1966, Nakamura-san, having reached the age of 55, retired from Tsuyama Chemical. At the end, she was being paid 30,000 yen, or about $85, a month. Her children were no longer dependent on her, and Toshio was ready to take on a son's responsibility for his aging mother. She felt at home in her body now. She rested when she needed to, and she had no worries about the cost of medical care, for she had finally picked up health book number 1023993. It was time for her to enjoy life. For her pleasure in being able to give gifts, she took up embroidery and the dressing of traditional kimekomi dolls, which are supposed to bring good luck. Wearing a bright kimono, she went once a week to dance at the study group of Japanese folk music. In set movements with expressive gestures, her hands now and then tucking up the long folds of the kimono sleeves, and with head held high, she danced, moving as if floating with 30 agreeable women to a song of celebration of entrance into a house. May your family flourish for 1,000 generations, for 8,000 generations. About a year after Nakamura-san retired, she was invited by an organization called the Bereaved Families Association to take a train trip with about 100 other war widows to visit the Yasukuni Shrine in Tokyo. This holy place, established in 1869, was dedicated to the spirits of all the Japanese who had died in wars against foreign powers, and could be thought roughly analogous, in terms of its symbolism for the nation, to the Arlington National Cemetery, with the difference that souls, not bodies, were hallowed there. The shrine was considered by many Japanese to be a focus of a still smoldering Japanese militarism, but Nakamura-san, who had never seen her husband's ashes and had held on to a belief that he would return to her someday, was oblivious of all that. She found the visit baffling. Besides the Hiroshima 100, there were huge crowds of women from other cities on the shrine grounds. It was impossible for her to summon up a sense of her dead husband's presence, and she returned home in an uneasy state of mind. Japan was booming. Things were still rather tight for the Nakamuras, and Toshio had to work very long hours, but the old days of bitter struggle began to seem remote. In 1975, one of the laws providing support to the Hibakusha was revised, and Nakamura-san began to receive a so-called health protection allowance of 6,000 yen, then about $20 a month. This would gradually be increased to more than twice that amount. She also received a pension, toward which she had contributed at Tsuyama, of 20,000 yen, or about $65 a month, and for several years she had been receiving a war widow's pension of another 20,000 yen a month. With the economic upswing, prices had, of course, risen steeply. In a few years, Tokyo would become the most expensive city in the world. But Toshio managed to buy a small Mitsubishi car, and occasionally he got up before dawn and rode a train for 2 hours to play golf with business associates. Yaeko's husband ran a shop for sales and service of air conditioners and heaters, and Mieko's husband ran a newsstand and candy shop near the railroad station. In May each year, around the time of the Emperor's birthday, when the trees along Broad Peace Boulevard were at their feathery best and banked azaleas were everywhere in bloom, Hiroshima celebrated a flower festival. Entertainment booths lined the boulevard, and there were long parades with floats and bands and thousands of marchers. In the 40th year after the bombing, Nakamura-san danced with the women of the Folk Dance Association, 6 dancers in each of 60 rows. They danced to Oiwai Ondo, a song of happiness, lifting their arms in gestures of joy and clapping in rhythms of threes. Green pine trees, cranes and turtles, you must tell a story of your hard times and laugh twice. The bombing had been 4 decades ago. How far away it seemed. The sun blazed that day. The measured steps and the constant lifting of the arms for hours at a time were tiring. In mid-afternoon, Nakamura-san suddenly felt woozy. The next thing she knew, she was being lifted, to her great embarrassment and in spite of begging to be let alone, into an ambulance. At the hospital, she said she was fine. All she wanted was to go home. She was allowed to leave. Two. Dr. Terufumi Sasaki. Dr. Terufumi Sasaki was still racked by memories of the appalling days and nights right after the explosion. Memories it would be his life work to distance himself from. Besides his duties as a junior surgeon at the Red Cross Hospital, he now had to spend every Thursday across the city at the University of Hiroshima to chip away at his doctoral dissertation on appendiceal tuberculosis. As was the custom in Japan, he had been permitted to start his practice as soon as he was graduated from medical school. It took most young interns 5 years of additional study to get their actual doctoral degree. In Dr. Sasaki's case, it was, for various reasons, to take 10. He had been commuting during that year from the small town of Mukaihara, where his mother lived, about an hour by train from the city. His family had money, and indeed, over the years it turned out, as it did for a great many Japanese doctors, that the most efficacious medicine for whatever ailed him would be cash or credit. The larger the dosage, the better. His grandfather had been a landlord and had accumulated wide mountain tracts of valuable woodland. His late father, a doctor, had earned good money in a private clinic. During the turbulent time of hunger and crime after the bombing, thieves had broken into two fort-like storage repositories next to his mother's house and taken many valued heirlooms, including a lacquer box given to the doctor's grandfather by the emperor, an ancient case for writing brushes and ink blocks, and a classic painting of a tiger alone worth 10 million yen, or more than $25,000. His marriage was working out well. He had been able to pick and choose. There had not been many such eligible young men as he in Mukaihara, and numerous marriage brokers had sounded him out. He had followed up some of these feelers. One father of an offered bride had received his agent and turned him down. Perhaps this was because Dr. Sasaki had a reputation of having been a very bad boy, a tomcat, some said, when he was young. And the father may have known about his illegal treatment of patients in Mukaihara in the evenings after his work at the Red Cross Hospital. But perhaps it was also because the father was overcautious. It was said of him that he not only followed the Japanese saying, "Check an old iron bridge well before crossing," he would not cross even after checking. Dr. Sasaki, never in his life having experienced such a rebuff, had decided that this was the girl for him, and with the help of two persistent go-betweens, he had eventually won the wary parent over. Now married only a few months, he was quickly learning that his wife was wiser and more sensible than he. Much of Dr. Sasaki's work as a surgeon at the Red Cross Hospital in the next 5 years was in the removal of keloid scars, hideously ugly, thick, itchy, rubbery, copper-red crab-like growths that often formed over bad burns that Hibakusha had suffered, and particularly those victims who had been exposed to the great heat of the bomb within 2 kilometers of the hypocenter. In dealing with the keloids, Dr. Sasaki and his colleagues were groping in the dark because they had no reliable literature to guide them. They found that after the bulbous scars had been removed, they often recurred. Some, if they were left unattended, became infected, and others caused underlying muscles to tense up. He and his colleagues eventually came to the reluctant conclusion that they should not have operated on many of the keloids. The scars tended in time to shrink spontaneously, and could then be more easily excised or be left alone. In 1951, Dr. Sasaki decided to quit working for the hospital with its awful memories and to set himself up as his father had done in a private clinic in Mukaihara. He was ambitious. He had had an older brother who, according to the custom of Japanese medical families, had been expected to succeed to the father's practice. The second son would have to make his own way, and in 1939, urged by the propaganda of the time to seek a fortune in the vast undeveloped reaches of China, Terufumi Sasaki had gone there and had studied at the Japanese Eastern Medical University in Qingdao. He had graduated and returned to Hiroshima shortly before the bombing. His brother had been killed in the war, so the way was clear for him not only to start a practice in his father's town, but also to withdraw from Hiroshima and, in effect, from being a hibakusha. For the next 4 decades, he also never spoke to anyone about the hours and days after the bombing. His grandfather having deposited large sums in the Bank of Hiroshima, Dr. Sasaki went to it confidently, expecting a big loan to help him get started. But the bank said that a clinic in such a small town could easily fail, and it put a cap on his credit of 300,000 yen, then less than $1,000. So Dr. Sasaki started treating patients in his wife's parents' house. He performed simple surgery on appendixes, gastric ulcers, compound fractures, but he also rather daringly practiced every other sort of medicine too, except gynecology and obstetrics. he did surprisingly well. Before long, he was getting nearly 100 patients a day. Some came to him from considerable distances. The bank noticed, and his limit of credit rose to 1 million yen. In 1954, he put up a proper clinic building within the compound of his wife's family. It was a two-story structure with 19 beds for inpatients and a total floor space of 280 mats. He financed the building with a loan of 300,000 yen from the bank and by selling timber from the lands he had inherited from his grandfather. In the new clinic, with a staff of 5 nurses and 3 on-the-job trainees, and working himself without pause 6 days a week from 8:30 in the morning till 6 in the evening, he continued to prosper. Long before this, doctors in Hiroshima had begun to find that there were much more serious consequences of exposure to the bomb than the traumatic wounds and keloid scars that had been so dramatically visible in the early days. The violent symptoms of primary radiation sickness wore off in time in most patients, but it soon became clear that hibakusha were liable to deeper and far more dangerous sequels from the enormous doses of radiation dealt them by the bomb. Above all, it was evident by 1950 that the incidence of leukemia in hibakusha was much higher than normal. Among those who had been exposed within 1 kilometer of the hypocenter, the incidence was reported to be between 10 and 50 times above the norm. Over the years, the appearance of purple spots, tiny surface hemorrhages, symptomatic of leukemia, came to be dreaded by hibakusha. And later on, other forms of cancer besides leukemia, with longer periods of latency, were showing up at higher than normal rates. Carcinomas of the thyroid, the lungs, the breast, the salivary glands, the stomach, the liver, the urinary tract, and the male and female reproductive organs. Some survivors, even children, were developing what were called A-bomb cataracts. Some exposed children were growing up stunted. And one of the most shocking findings was that some children who had been in their mother's womb at the time of the bombing were born with heads smaller than normal. Because it was known that radiation affected the genes of laboratory animals, a fear spread among many hibakusha that future descendants of the survivors might be subject to mutations. It was the late 60s before analyses indeed showed some chromosome aberrations in Hiroshima and Nagasaki survivors, and it would, of course, take much longer to tell what, if any, effects there would be on their progeny. There were several ailments, less life-threatening than the cancers, that were thought by many doctors and by most of the people who were subject to them to have resulted from exposure to the bomb. Several sorts of anemia, liver dysfunction, sexual problems, endocrine disorders, accelerated aging, and the not quite really sick yet undeniable debilitation of which so many complained. Dr. Sasaki, who had himself suffered nothing but this last, paid little or no attention to any of these revelations. He did not follow them closely in the medical journals. In his town in the hills, he treated few hibakusha. He lived enclosed in the present tense. In 1963, wanting to get caught up on the latest developments in anesthesia, Dr. Sasaki went to the Yokohama Red Cross Hospital to learn about them from its director general, Dr. Tatsutaro Hattori. As chief of surgery at the Hiroshima Hospital, Dr. Hattori had been Dr. Sasaki's boss there. He had come down with radiation sickness after the bombing and had moved to Yokohama. Dr. Hattori suggested that Dr. Sasaki might as well have a thorough physical examination, taking advantage of the hospital's up-to-the-minute equipment while he was there, and Dr. Sasaki agreed. A tomographic scan of his chest showed up a shadow in the left lung. Dr. Sasaki smoked. Without going into what had been learned about the incidence of lung cancer in hibakusha, perhaps supposing that Dr. Sasaki would know all about such things, Dr. Hattori recommended a biopsy. It was done, and when Dr. Sasaki came out of the anesthetic, he found that his entire left lung had been removed. A few hours after the operation, a ligature of one of the blood vessels into the lung cavity gave way, and Dr. Sasaki suffered severe hemorrhaging for nearly a week. One day, toward the end of that time, as he continued to cough up blood and grew worrisomely feeble, there gathered around him what he construed as a death watch. His wife, Dr. Hattori, the hospital matron, several nurses. He thanked them, said goodbye to his wife, and died. Or, rather, he thought he died. Sometime later, he regained consciousness and found himself on the mend. In later years, Dr. Sasaki came to think of that experience as the most important of his life, more important than the bombing. Haunted by the loneliness he had felt when he thought he was dying, he now did his best to move closer to his wife and his children, two sons and two daughters. An aunt startled him one day by saying, "You are lucky, Terufumi. After all, Iwa Jinjutsu, medicine is the art of compassion." He had never thought about the meaning of this saying, which is held up before all young Japanese training to be doctors. He determined thenceforth to be calm and composed, and not to leave undone anything he could do for a patient. He would try to be kind to people he detested. He would give up hunting and mahjong. His wife said, "You've reached maturity in your 40s. I grew up when I was in my 20s. He did not give up cigarettes. In 1972, Dr. Sasaki's wife died of breast cancer, the third crisis of his life. He achieved now another sort of loneliness connected with death, this one non-transient and intense. He threw himself more tirelessly than ever into his work. His wife's death and his own near death, together with his realization that he was no longer young, started him thinking about the elderly, and he decided to build a much larger new clinic where he would practice geriatric medicine. This branch of the compassionate art was attracting some of the ablest Japanese doctors, and it also happened to be growing extremely lucrative. As he put it to friends, who laughed at what they considered his overreaching, everyone after 60 had aches and pains. Everyone as old as that needed massage, heat therapy, acupuncture, moxa, and comfort from a friendly physician. They would come in flocks. By 1977, Dr. Sasaki's credit with the Bank of Hiroshima had soared, and it granted him a loan of 19 million yen, or about $80,000. With this money, he put up, on land on the edge of town, an imposing four-story concrete building with 19 beds for inpatients and with extensive facilities for rehabilitation, and also with a splendid apartment for himself. He took on a staff of 3 acupuncturists, 3 therapists, 8 nurses, and 15 paramedics and maintenance people. His 2 sons, Yoshihisa and Ryuji, by now both doctors, came to help out in specially busy periods. He was right about the flocks. Again, he worked from 8:30 to 6, 6 days a week, and he saw an average of 250 patients a day. Some came to him from cities as far away as Kure, Ondo, and Akitsu on the coast, and others from villages all over the prefecture. Taking advantage of huge tax deductions that Japanese doctors could claim, he saved large sums, and as he returned money on his bank loans, the bank kept raising his line of credit. He got the idea of building an old people's home, which would cost 200 million yen. It would be necessary to get approval for this project from the Takata County Medical Association. He submitted plans. He was turned down. Soon afterward, a leading member of the association built in the city of Yoshida just such a home as Dr. Sasaki had proposed. Undaunted, Dr. Sasaki, aware that the 3 foremost pleasures of his elderly patients were family visits, good food, and a relaxed bath time, used the bank's loans to build, on the site of his former clinic, a luxurious bathhouse. This was ostensibly for patients, but he opened it to the townspeople as well, charging more for admission than the usual public bathhouse did. Its tubs, after all, were of marble. He spent 500,000 deductible yen a month on its upkeep. Every morning, Dr. Sasaki met with the entire staff of the clinic. He had a favorite lecture: do not work primarily for money. Do your duty to patients first and let the money follow. Our life is short, we don't live twice. The whirlwind will pick up the leaves and spin them, but then it will drop them and they will form a pile. Dr. Sasaki's own pile grew and grew. His life was insured for 100 million yen. He was insured against malpractice for 300 million yen. He drove a white BMW. Rare vases stood on chests in his living room. In spite of the enormous tax deductions allowed Japanese doctors, he had come to be the payer of the highest income tax in Takata County, population 37,000. And his tax was among the 10 highest in all of Hiroshima Prefecture, 12 cities and 68 towns in 15 counties, population 2,700,000. He had a new idea. He would drill down next to the clinic for subterranean hot water to fill hot springs baths. He hired the Tokyo Geological Engineering Company to do a survey, and it assured him that if he drilled down 800 meters, he would get from 60 to 100 liters of water a minute at between 79 and 86 degrees Fahrenheit. He had visions of a hot springs spa. He calculated that he could supply water for hot baths in 3 hotels. He started digging in June 1985. Dr. Sasaki began to be considered a bit strange by Hiroshima doctors. He was not attracted, as they were, to the exclusive high society of the medical associations. Instead, he went in for such things as sponsoring a Mukaihara contest in gateball, a primitive variant of croquet. He often wore a necktie which cost him 5,000 yen or $20, with gateball embroidered across it in English script. His principal pleasure, apart from his work, was to take an occasional trip to Hiroshima to eat Chinese food in the basement of the Grand Hotel, lighting up at the end of the meal a cigarette of the brand Mild 7, which had printed on its packet, besides its name in English, this courteous Japanese admonition: let's be careful not to smoke too much for the sake of our health. He could face Hiroshima now, because a gaudy phoenix had risen from the ruinous desert of 1945. A remarkably beautiful city of more than 1 million inhabitants, only 1 in 10 of whom was a hibakusha, with tall modern buildings on broad tree-lined avenues, crowded with Japanese cars, all of which had English lettering on them and appeared to be brand new. A city of strivers and sybarites, with 753 bookstores and 2,356 bars. If past memories did stir up in him, Dr. Sasaki had come to be able to live with his one bitter regret: that in the shambles of the Red Cross Hospital in those first days after the bombing, it had not been possible, beyond a certain point, to keep track of the identities of those whose corpses were dragged out to the mass cremations, with the result that nameless souls might still, all these years later, be hovering there, unattended and dissatisfied. 3. Father Wilhelm Kleinsorge. Back in the hospital in Tokyo for the second time, Father Kleinsorge was suffering from fever, diarrhea, wounds that would not heal, wildly fluctuating blood counts, and utter exhaustion. For the rest of his life, his was to be a classic case history of that vague, borderline form of A-bomb sickness, in which a person's body developed a rich repertory of symptoms, few of which could be positively attributed to radiation, but many of which turned up in hibakusha in various combinations and degrees, so often as to be blamed by some doctors and almost all patients on the bomb. Father Kleinsorge lived this life of misery with the most extraordinarily selfless spirit. After his discharge from the hospital, he returned to the tiny Noborimachi chapel he had helped build, and there he continued his self-abnegating pastoral life. In 1948, he was named priest of the much grander Misasa Church in another part of town. There were not yet many tall buildings in the city, and neighbors called the big church the Misasa Palace. A convent of Helpers of Holy Souls was attached to the church, and besides his priestly duties of conducting Mass, hearing confessions, and teaching Bible classes, he ran 8-day retreats for novices and sisters of the convent, during which the women, given communion and instructed by him from day to day, would maintain silence. He still visited Sasaki-san and other Hibakusha who were sick and wounded, and he would even babysit for young mothers. He often went to the sanatorium at Saijyo, an hour by train from the city, to comfort tubercular patients. Father Kleinsorge was briefly hospitalized in Tokyo twice more. His German Jesuit colleagues were of the opinion that in all his work he was a little too much concerned for others and not enough for himself. Beyond his own stubborn sense of mission, he had taken on himself the Japanese spirit of Enryo, setting the self apart, putting the wishes of others first. They thought he might literally kill himself with kindness to others. He was too rücksichtsvoll, they said, too regardful. When gifts of delicacies came from relatives in Germany, he gave them all away. When he got penicillin from an occupation doctor, he gave it to parishioners who were not as sick as he. Among his many other complaints, he had syphilis, which he had apparently caught from transfusions in one of his hospital stays. It was cured eventually. He gave lessons on the catechism when he had a high fever. After he came back from a long hike of pastoral calls, the Misasa housekeeper would see him collapse on the steps of his rectory, head down, a figure it seemed of utter defeat. The next day he would be out in the streets again. Gradually, over years of this unremitting labor, he gathered his modest harvest, some 400 baptisms, some 40 marriages. Father Kleinsorge loved the Japanese and their ways. One of his German colleagues, Father Berzikofer, jokingly said that Father Kleinsorge was married to Japan. Shortly after he moved to the Misasa Church, he read that a new law on naturalization had been passed by the Diet with these requirements: that one live in Japan for at least 5 years, be over 20 years old and mentally sound, be of good character, be able to support oneself, and be able to accept single nationality. He hastened to submit proofs that he met all these, and after some months of review he was accepted. He registered himself as a Japanese citizen under the name he would henceforth bear, Father Makoto Takakura. For a few months in the spring and summer of 1956, his poor health declining still further, Father Takakura filled a temporary vacancy in a small parish in the Midorimachi district. 5 years before that, the Reverend Mr. Kiyoshi Tanimoto, whom Father Takakura knew well, had begun giving Bible classes to a group of girls whose faces had been disfigured by keloids. Later, some of them had been taken, as so-called Hiroshima maidens, to the United States for plastic surgery. One of them, Tomoko Nakabayashi, whom Father Takakura had converted and baptized, died on an operating table at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Her ashes were carried to her family when the first group of maidens returned to Hiroshima that summer of 1956, and it fell to Father Takakura to preside at her funeral. During it, he nearly fainted. At Noborimachi, he began instructing the female members, a mother and two daughters, of a wealthy and cultured family named Naganishi. Feverish or not, he went to them, always on foot, every evening. Sometimes he would arrive early. He would pace up and down the street outside, then ring the bell at precisely 7 o'clock. He would look at himself in a hall mirror, adjust his hair and habit, and enter the living room. He would teach for an hour. Then the Naganishis would serve tea and sweets, and he and they would chat until exactly 10. He felt at home in that house. The younger daughter, Hisako, became devoted to him, and when, after 18 months, his various symptoms grew so bad that he was going to have to be hospitalized, she asked him to baptize her, and he did, on the day before he entered the Hiroshima Red Cross Hospital for an entire year's stay. His most disturbing complaint was a weird infection in his fingers, which had become bloated with pus and would not heal. He had fever and flu-like symptoms. His white blood count was seriously low, and he had pain in his knees, particularly the left one, and in other joints. His fingers were operated on and slowly healed. He was treated for leukopenia. Before his discharge, an ophthalmologist found that he had the beginnings of an A-bomb cataract. He returned to the large Misasa congregation, but it was harder and harder for him to carry the kind of overload he cherished. He developed back pain, which was caused, doctors said, by a kidney stone. He passed it. Dragged down by constant pain and by infections that were abetted by his shortage of white cells, he limped through his days, pushing himself beyond his strength. Finally, in 1961, he was mercifully put out to pasture by the diocese in a tiny church in the country town of Mukaihara, the town where Dr. Sasaki was flourishing in his private clinic. The compound of the Mukaihara church, at the crest of a steep rise from the town, enclosed a small chapel with an oaken table for an altar and with space for a flock of about 20 to kneel, Japanese fashion, on a spread of tatami matting, and uphill a cramped parsonage. Father Takakura chose as his bedroom in the parsonage a room no more than 6 feet square and as bare as a monk's cell. He ate in another such cell next to it, and the kitchen and bathroom beyond were dark, chilly, sunken rooms no larger than the others. Across a narrow corridor running the length of the building were an office and a much larger bedroom which Father Takakura, true to his nature, reserved for guests. When he first arrived, he felt enterprising, and, on the principle that souls are best caught while unripe, he had builders add 2 rooms to the chapel and started in them what he called the St. Mary's Kindergarten. So began a bleak life for 4 Catholics, the priest, 2 Japanese sisters to teach the babies, and a Japanese woman to cook. Few believers came to church. His parish consisted of 4 previously converted families, about 10 worshippers in all. Some Sundays, no one showed up for Mass. After its first spurt, Father Takakura's energy rapidly flagged. Once each week, he took a train to Hiroshima and went to the Red Cross Hospital for a checkup. At Hiroshima Station, he picked up what he loved best to read as he traveled, timetables, with schedules of trains going all over Honshu Island. The doctors injected steroids in his painful joints and treated him for the chronic flu-like symptoms, and once he reported he had found traces of blood in his underwear, which the doctors guessed came from new kidney stones. In the village of Mukaihara, he tried to be as inconspicuous, as Japanese, as he could. He sometimes wore Japanese clothes. Not wanting to seem high living, he never bought meat in the local market, but sometimes he smuggled some out from the city. A Japanese priest who occasionally came to see him, Father Hasegawa, admired his efforts to carry his naturalization through to perfection, but found him, in many ways, unshakably German. He had a tendency, when he was rebuffed in an undertaking, to stubbornly push all the harder straight for it, whereas a Japanese would more tactfully look for some way around. Father Hasegawa noticed that when Father Takakura was hospitalized, he rigidly respected the hospital's visiting hours, and if people came, even from far away, to see him outside proper hours, he refused to receive them. Once, eating with his friend, Father Hasegawa declined his host's offer of a bowl of rice. He said he was full. But then delicious pickles appeared, which caused a Japanese palate to cry out for rice, and he decided to have a bowl after all. Father Takakura was outraged. That is, in his guest's view, German. How could he eat rice plus pickle when he had been too full to eat rice alone? During this period, Father Takakura was one of many people whom Dr. Robert J. Lifton interviewed in preparing to write his book, Death in Life, Survivors of Hiroshima. In one conversation, the priest hinted that he realized he had achieved a truer identity as a Hibakusha than as a Japanese. "If a person says to me that he is weary, Darui, if it is a Hibakusha who says it, it gives me a different feeling than if he is an ordinary person. He doesn't have to explain. He knows all of the uneasiness, all of the temptation to lose spirit and be depressed, and of then starting again to see if he can do his job. If a Japanese hears the words Tenoheika, His Majesty the Emperor, it is different from a Westerner hearing them, a very different feeling in the foreigner's heart from what is felt in the Japanese person's heart. It is a similar question in the case of one who is a victim and one who is not, when they hear about another victim. I met a man one time who said, I experienced the atomic bomb. And from then on the conversation changed. We both understood each other's feelings. Nothing had to be said. In 1966, Father Takakura had to change cooks. A woman named Satsue Yoshiki, who was 35 years old, recently cured of tuberculosis, and recently baptized, had been told to report for an interview at the Mukaihara Church. Having been given the Japanese name of the priest, she was astonished to be greeted by a big geijin, a foreigner, dressed in a quilted Japanese gown. His face, which was rounded out and puffy, doubtless from medication, struck her as that of a baby. At once, indeed, there commenced a relationship soon to blossom into one of complete mutual trust, in which her role seemed to be ambiguous, part daughter, part mother. His growing helplessness kept her in subjugation. She tenderly nursed him. Her cooking was primitive, his temper cranky. He had said he would eat anything, even Japanese noodles, but he was sharp with her about his food, as he had never been with anyone else. Once he spoke of strained baked potatoes his real mother had cooked. She tried to make them. He said, "These are not like my mother's." He loved fried prawns and ate them when he went to Hiroshima for checkups. She tried to cook them. He said, "These are burned." She stood beside him in the tiny eating room, her hands behind her gripping the door jamb so tightly that in time its paint was all worn away. Yet he praised her, confided in her, joked with her, apologized to her each time he lost his temper. She thought him, under the shortness which she attributed to pain, gentle, pure, patient, sweet, humorous, and deeply kind. Once on a late spring day, not long after Yoshiki-san arrived, sparrows alighted in a persimmon tree outside his office window. He clapped his hands to drive them away, and soon there appeared on his palms purple spots of the sort that all Hibakusha dreaded. The doctors in Hiroshima shook their heads. Who could say what they were? They seemed to be blood bruises, but his blood tests did not suggest leukemia. He had slight hemorrhages in his urinary tract. "What if I get blood in my brains?" he asked once. His joints still hurt. He developed liver dysfunction, high blood pressure, back pains, chest pains. An electrocardiogram turned up an anomaly. He was put on a drug to ward off a coronary attack and on an antihypertensive drug. He was given steroids, hormones, an anti-diabetic drug. "I don't take medicines, I eat them," he said to Yoshiki-san. In 1971, he was hospitalized for an operation to see whether his liver was cancerous. It was not. All through this time of decline, a stream of visitors came to see him, thanking him for all he had done for them in the past. Hisako Naganishi, the woman he had baptized the day before his long hospitalization, was especially faithful. She brought him open-faced sandwiches on German rye bread, which he loved, and when Yoshiki-san needed a vacation, she would move in and tend him in her absence. Father Berzikofer would come for a few days at a time, and they would talk and drink a great deal of gin, which Father Takakura had also come to love. One winter day, at the beginning of 1976, Father Takakura slipped and fell on the steep, icy path down to town. The next morning, Yoshiki-san heard him shouting her name. She found him in the bathroom, leaning over the washstand, unable to move. With all the strength of her love, she carried him, he weighed 175 pounds, to his bed and laid him down. For a month, he was unable to move. She improvised a bedpan and cared for him day and night. Finally, she borrowed a wheelchair from the town office and took him to Dr. Sasaki's clinic. The two men had known each other years before, but now, one living in his monk's cell and the other about to move into his grand new apartment in the four-story clinic, they were light years apart. Dr. Sasaki took an X-ray, saw nothing, diagnosed neuralgia, and advised massage. Father Takakura could not abide the idea of the usual female massager. A man was hired. During the workout, Father Takakura held Yoshiki-san's hand, and his face reddened. The pain was unbearable. Yoshiki-san hired a car and drove Father Takakura to the city to the Red Cross Hospital. An X-ray on a bigger machine showed fractures of the 11th and 12th thoracic vertebrae. He was operated on to relieve pressure on the right sciatic nerve, and he was fitted with a corset. From then on, he was bedridden. Yoshiki-san fed him, changed diapers that she made for him, and cleaned his body. He read the Bible and timetables, the only two sorts of texts, he told Yoshiki-san, that never told lies. He could tell you what train to take where, the price of food in the dining car, and how to change trains at such and such a station to save 300 yen. One day he called Yoshiki-san, greatly excited. He had found an error. Only the Bible told the truth. His fellow priests finally persuaded him to go to Kobe Kaisei Hospital in Kobe. Yoshiki-san visited him, and he drew out from a book a copy of his chart on which was written, "A living corpse." He said he wanted to go home with her, and she took him. "Because of you, my soul has been able to get through purgatory," he said to her when he was in his own bed. He weakened, and his fellow priests moved him to a two-room house in a hollow just below their novitiate, in Nagatsuka. Yoshiki-san told him she wanted to sleep in his room, with him. No, he said, his vows would not permit that. She lied, saying that the Father Superior had ordered it. Greatly relieved, he allowed it. After that, he seldom opened his eyes. She fed him only ice cream. When visitors came, all he could say was, "Thank you." He fell into a coma, and on November 19, 1977, with a doctor, a priest, and Yoshiki-san at his side, this explosion-affected person took a deep breath and died. He was buried in a serene pine grove at the top of the hill above the novitiate. Father Wilhelm M. Takakura, S.J., R.I.P. The fathers and brothers of the Nagatsuka novitiate noticed over the years that there were almost always fresh flowers at that grave.